Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for joining me this hour. Theodore Roosevelt, he died 100 years ago this year. From 1901 to 1909, he was the 26th president, and he has a complex legacy. He was known as the conservation president, but loved to hunt. He was a rough rider, although he was kind of small in stature with some bad eyesight. He was a trust buster, but also to the manner born, and he's remembered as Teddy, though he preferred Theodore. And to add to the contradictions, he was born and raised here in New York City, but a new book chronicles how it was the Wild West that made the man, not the east side of Manhattan where he was born. Author and historian Michael Blake's book, The Cowboy President, The American West, and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt, unpacks the influential time Roosevelt spent in the Dakota Territories and how he became the president etched on Mount Rushmore. Michael, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's so interesting. We got, because of this 100-year marker, we got a lot of books. There are a lot of books about Theodore Roosevelt out there right now. But yours stood out to us because there were 3 years you spent tracing every step Roosevelt took. You went horseback riding, cattle herding, forging rivers. Why was this important to your writing process?
Well, I knew Louis L'Amour, the author, and Louis always believed that if you're going to write about a place, you have to see the land from that point of view. You have to experience it. You can't just look it up in a book and write about it. You have to be part of the land. And I totally understood what he said. And in order to talk about that area and what it meant to Theodore and the impression it made, you had to be there. You had to have boots on the ground, so to speak. You know, it's like there's a portion in the book where we talk about there's a thing called Bennonite clay, which is a bluish gray clay. And when it's dry, it looks like popcorn. But when it gets wet, it becomes real sticky and gumbo-like and gelatin-like. And one time when I was going through the national park with my wife on many of my trips there, I saw some on the side of the road and stopped the car, hopped out, and stuck my hands in the mud to feel what it was like, to get an idea. And, of course, probably because my mom never let me play in the mud when I was a kid. But I wanted to feel what it was like. I had heard about it, but you know, you have an opportunity to see it and feel what it was like and how it stuck to everything. It just gives a writer more gravitas when you're talking about something, if you really can know what you're writing about and talking about.
You have an incredibly interesting background yourself. You're the author of 7 books, but you were a child actor. You're the son of a well-known character actor, Larry Blake. You are an Emmy Award-winning makeup artist in Hollywood. When and how did you develop this commitment to researching Theodore Roosevelt?
Well, I was a cowboy crazy kid of 8, and not much has changed except the price of the toys. And my mom and dad gave me a photo illustrated book of presidents. And of course, I knew Washington and I knew about Lincoln because of my interest in the Civil War as a kid. But I was really disappointed that all the presidents during the American West period, every photo you see of them, they're in top hats, frock coats, not one of them on a cowboy horse with a saddle and hat. And I turned the page, and as I like to say, the heavens opened up, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang hallelujah, and here's this photo of Theodore in his buckskin clothing, his hat, his gun on his hip, standing next to his horse Manitou, and the caption said something to the effect of, Theodore Roosevelt was a Dakota cowboy, and I said, That's my kind of idea of president. And that's when he became my favorite president. And then, of course, as I got older and I read more and more about the man, he just astounds me every day, what this man did with his life in 60 short years.
When did he first head out west and why?
Well, he first went out west in 1883 to hunt a buffalo. And he had horrible luck trying to hunt a buffalo. They couldn't find any, because by then, in the area of the Dakotas, the buffalo had disappeared to well below 100. And anyway, one night they're out with he's out with his guide, and they have nowhere to camp, so they set up camp in the middle of nowhere and tie the horses to their saddle and the horses got spooked and yanked the saddles out from underneath them, and they had to find the horses. They get back, get into sleep, and it starts raining. And within minutes, he's seated in about 4 inches of water, and his guide figures, oh, this guy is never going to want to stay doing this. And Theodore turned to him and said, by Godfrey, isn't this fun? And he got his first buffalo, which the buffalo head is still on display at Sagamore Hill. And he got interested in the cattle industry at the same time, and he bought a ranch there, the Maltese Cross Ranch. And he came back as a cattle owner. He wanted to live the life of a cowboy. One of the things people need to understand about Theodore is he was a romanticist, not just in the terms of a man and a woman, which he was, but he had one foot in the 19th century, and then he also had his other foot firmly planted in the beginnings of the 20th century. But he longed to be a cowboy. He wanted to be a cowboy. That's why in later life he associated himself with Bat Masterson and Seth Bullock and other well-known Western figures.
So when you mentioned that he went out to shoot a buffalo and that he was a romantic, how was he received by the people who were living out there, working the land, hardworking folks? This guy comes from the East Coast with these romantic ideas.
Well, first off, Theodore had glasses. He was horribly, horribly nearsighted. Couldn't see more than 8 feet ahead of him without the glasses. And he had a very high voice. Some described it as a squeak. And, you know, he dressed in buckskins, which was not the traditional garb of a working cowboy, but it was his idea because Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett were his childhood heroes. And everybody thought, oh, my God, it's another Eastern dude. And they used to call him Storm Windows because of his glasses. And then one night he had been out looking for stray cattle, and he wound up staying in a little ramshackle two-story building in Mingusville, Montana. And this drunken cowboy was there, and he was shooting up the place and just being a complete pain in the neck. And he spots Theodore when he walks in with his glasses and says, Four Eyes is going to treat. And Theodore tried to avoid him. And he kept bothering Theodore. And Theodore always said, if it's at all possible, never get involved in a fight. But if you do get involved in a fight, put your opponent to sleep. So he said, well, if I've got to, I've got to. And he threw the table aside, and he hit the man with a sharp right, left, right jab. The man went down, hit his head on the bar, knocked himself unconscious. They locked him up in a smokehouse, and the next morning the guy disappeared on a freight train. I have no idea who he was, but the story got around, and after that, all the locals called him Mr. Roosevelt.
My guest is Michael F. Blake. He's written a book called The Cowboy President, The American West, and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. So just to give people a sense of how different his life was out there, growing up, what was Theodore Roosevelt like before this epic Western period?
Oh, Theodore was a child of privilege. His father helped start the American Natural History Museum in New York City, was quite a philanthropist. He was self-taught, self-educated by tutors in that. He led a very privileged life. He was the Roosevelts go back to seven generations in New York. So he was certainly a New York blue blood. You know, the parents took the family on a trip to Europe when he was just about 12 and that, and he saw all the sights. So he certainly had a very, in many ways, a sheltered but very well-to-do lifestyle, which was totally opposite what he did when he went out west.
You know, you write something very interesting about him and his life and the way he went through life. You wrote, Theodore's tendency to completely ignore something that was painful to him would become very obvious in two decades. One, why did he do this idea of ignoring something very painful? And we're talking about is the death of his wife, right?
Yes. Just imagine you're you're a New York assemblyman. You go up to Albany to see a bill through. Your wife is about to give birth. He gets a telegram. You're now a father. Everyone's congratulating him, pats on the back. And within 2 hours, he gets another telegram, come home quickly. And he's greeted at the front door of the home by his brother, Elliot, who says, there's a curse on this house. Mother is dying, and so is Alice. And this is on both. He loses within hours his mother and his wife on Valentine's Day. Sent him into a total spiral. People actually, relatives out, really thought he was going to go crazy because he was so overcome with grief. So Theodore had a mechanism in him that he would literally shut things off and not discuss it. For instance, in his autobiography, he never mentions his first wife, Alice, at all. When he leaves the presidency, he goes to Africa to be as far away from anything as possible so he doesn't hear what's going on, which didn't really happen because letters finally caught up to him and he found out how disappointing President Taft was, who was his handpicked successor. So he would do this. It was a way of him of self-preservation, actually. That's the way. It was a coping mechanism, and that's how he managed to get through life.
Let's talk about two of the biggest contradictions of Theodore Roosevelt, within Theodore Roosevelt, the environment. So he's known as this conservation president, led to 230 million acres of public land. He wrote this. This is from your book. It is also vandalism wantonly to destroy or permit the destruction of what is beautiful in nature, whether it be a cliff, a forest, a species of mammal or bird. But then he was this avid hunter. You said he could instantly establish a bird sanctuary with a swipe of a pen, yet go out and shoot a bird.
Mm-hmm.
One, was he aware of this contradiction?
Oh, very much so. But he never... You have to go back and look at the times. And at that time, hunting was a rite of passage for young men. And he hunted... When he was out west, he only hunted basically for food. Like if he did hunt down pronghorn antelopes, he hunted them for food. He hunted them for food and then took the head as a trophy. But he was never one to overhunt, and he really despised people who just hunted just for the hides and things like that. And actually, one fellow, Jack Willis, had been doing that, and he convinced them to give it up. So he was very much a hunter, but he was also very much aware of everything. He wanted, when he went to Africa, he hunted a lot of animals, because you have to remember, back then most cities did not have zoos. He was one of the founders of the Bronx Zoo in New York City. So he went on behest of the Smithsonian Institute, which they then, you know, mounted these animals so people could see in a museum, because we didn't have the zoos and the nature parks like we do now. And he really, it's a contradictory about him, but he never was excessive in his hunting. He never just simply went out and wantonly killed animals. There was always a purpose, mainly for food and then for scientific study.
And then the other contradiction in him that is about race. So he was a fierce opponent of slavery. He regarded it as a sin, but he was part of the westward expansion, which wiped out huge amount of native lands. And he sort of infamously said, I don't go so far as to think the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. How do you think we square Roosevelt's racism towards Native Americans and these words with his quest for westward expansion and his legacy as a president?
Well, again, you know, it's easy when we're several decades later, hopefully more enlightened or have different attitudes, but you have to look at the times. And at the times, he had dealt with Indians. He was very good friends with many Indians. Quanah Parker, the great Comanche chief, they were tremendous friends. Quanah Parker adored Roosevelt. But at the time of the westward expansion, you had two different societies, if you will, and they clashed together, and neither one really understood each other. And it was a natural progression. It's something you can see throughout the time of history, that different societies who had different cultures and different experiences, and they ran into each other. And even Theodore knew the open, he even said that the time of the open range for the cattlemen, and the cattlemen fencing off their land, would have to make way for the farmers. So he also saw it that way, that, you know, it's always the strong shall survive, and the dominant force will always take over, whether it was the Indians, whether it was the cattlemen versus the farmers, or whatever. So it's a hard way to sit here and say now. You can say, a person can say, well, he shouldn't have said this or he shouldn't have done this, but you also have to go back and look at the times when it was happening, when depredations on both sides, whether it was the whites or the Indians, were being committed by both sides, and some quite savagely and brutally, and it just lent itself to those attitudes.
Yeah, it's just one of those things when you're talking about, you know, and we deal with all of our presidents, right? We deal with Jefferson and Washington being slave owners. It's part of trying to talk about the fuller history in a way.
Yes, and you have to look at the time. You know, it's easy nowadays. We look at things, and like I say, we're more progressive. We're more enlightened on things. Things have changed, and we look back at 100 or 200 years ago of history and go, oh, well, that's wrong, or oh, they're doing this, or we should not have a monument for this person or that. It's like, well, wait a minute, folks, you got to take a step back and you got to look at what was the times like. You have to look at history in the eyes of the time of the history you're looking at. You can't be a Monday morning quarterback and not be on the field where it happened.
Well, I'm not sure I 100% agree with you, but I take your point. My guest is Michael Blake. The Cowboy President is the name of his book. So can you tell me the story of why we all call him Teddy, even though he liked Theodore?
Well, his first wife, Alice, had called him T.D. or Teddy. And, of course, after her death, he didn't want to be reminded. And he always said the name Teddy was the name of a boy, not a man. Well, of course, he goes hunting for a black bear in Mississippi. Again, has horrible luck in finding a bear. It's like all the black bears heard he was coming to Mississippi, packed their bags, and left. And they finally found a old, beat-up old bear who was like maybe 225 pounds and very sickly, and they tied him to a tree, and they called Roosevelt, grab your rifle, we've got a bear for you. And he sees this poor bear, and he says, absolutely not, I'm not going to have anything to do with it, it's not sportsmanlike. And he ordered the bear be put down because he could tell it was very sick and old. And Clifford Berryman, who was a cartoonist for the Washington Post, did this great drawing of Theodore refusing to shoot a little bear cub. And Morris Mitchum, who was in Brooklyn, who had a little novelty store, wrote Roosevelt and said, you know, my wife makes these little stuffed dolls. Would you mind terribly if we named them after you? And Roosevelt reportedly said, well, I don't see how naming a stuffed doll after me is going to help you, but go ahead. And his wife made these little stuffed bears, put them in the window, and called them Teddy's Bears, sold them for $1.50. Morris Mitchum later formed the Ideal Toy Corporation, which ran for over 80 years. At the same time, there was another toy buyer in Germany who saw these stuffed bears, and he heard about the story about Theodore, brought the bear over, and hence the teddy bear came to fruition, and Teddy and Theodore became one and the same. And no matter how much Theodore didn't want to be called Teddy, you even had songs named after, we want our Teddy, we love our Teddy. So it was kind of a losing battle for him.
The name of the book is The Cowboy President, The American West, and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Michael Blake, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, it's time to check in with WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet, for this week's Andy in the Archives. More after the break. Stay with us.